This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 34 years ago today, the Supreme Court issued its historic decision in Roe v. Wade. Ever since, defenders of abortion rights and anti-abortion activists have waged ideological warfare so fierce that it left little or no room for common ground. As part of NPR's special series, Crossing the Divide, we're going to take a look at how a group of activists from both sides addressed each other and the abortion debate in their home state of Massachusetts. They didn't change any minds. In fact, agreeing not to try to change minds was part of the ground rules. But they did learn to respect each other and each other's opinions. And along the way, they helped to reduce the rancor that so often attends the abortion argument. We've asked one from each side to talk to us today about how they learned to talk to each other and about what they learned. Later on the opinion page, an editor of a libertarian magazine defends surveillance cameras. Yeah, surprised us too. But first, crossing the divide on abortion. Do you have any friends or family members on the other side of the fence, co-workers? Do you talk about your differences on abortion, or do you avoid the issue altogether? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. Frances Hogan, president of Women Affirming Life, and Nikki Nichols Gamble, chair of the Center for Reproductive Rights, were part of the small group of women from Massachusetts who met in secret to talk through their differences. The Public Conversations Project formed after seven people were shot in an attack on an abortion clinic outside Boston in 1994. They went public 6 years ago. They've kept in touch since, and they're here with us now today from member station WBUR in Boston. It's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Nikki Nichols Gamble, let me begin with you. Did you have to learn to call the other side by the name they call themselves, which is pro-life?
Well, actually, that was one of the major issues of discussion in our small group dialogue. I guess I was the only one in the dialogue that simply was not willing to do that. There was an effort to have all of us come to an ability to call each other by what each group wanted, but I found that that was just not possible for me.
Mm-hmm. So you could not swallow pro-life.
I couldn't swallow calling someone else pro-life with the implication that I was not pro-life.
Mm-hmm. And Frances Hogan, I assume that these minefields were scattered throughout your conversations.
Well, they were, Neil, and I noticed that in your introduction you referred to my side of the issue as anti-abortion. And I think that in the effort to lower the rhetoric around the issue, at least I thought it was important that we do call each group what the group would prefer to be called.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Boston Globe, which had a style book which said that they were not to use the phrase pro-life, agreed to use it when we went public with this a few years ago.
Indeed, so have we, and I deliberately excluded it so I could set up this starting point of the conversation, because it's such a hot button.
Well, it is a hot button, and much of what we learned through the Public Conversations Project was to try to set aside the hot button words and phrases so that we could get to understand the other person's opinion. And I think that we came to be able to do that in a respectful manner. I must make one more statement, though. In your introduction, mm-hmm. you said that we respected each person, which we did, but we also respected the other person's opinions about this particular issue, which I must tell you honestly that I do not, even though I respect Nikki as a person. And I know this set up some tension between Nikki and me, but I wanted to be clear about that.
Okay, so we've found a couple of minefields right at the beginning. Nikki, let me begin, go back to you and say, given the passion on both sides, given the fact that you had agreed from the beginning not to try to change each other's minds, why was this important?
Well, I think that the dialogue itself was incredibly important, especially in Massachusetts in 1995, following the murders of two clinic receptionists. Emotions were very, very high. I think many of us were really frightened that there might be more violence. And I think that when we started with a real effort to try to de-escalate the violence. I think we also de-escalated the fear. We were able to move from demonizing one another to actually, I think, understanding the positions that each of us had on this issue. We found a way to handle the great divide, I think, with civility. and with respect, at least at minimum, for the individuals. And that was very important to do. It certainly taught me that one shouldn't broad brush everyone on the other side of an issue with the same sort of negativity that I was accustomed to doing at the time with those with whom I disagree.
Francis Hogan, were you similarly ready to stereotype your opponents on this side before you began these conversations?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I will tell you one brief story. The night that this happened, that John Salvey went into the clinics and killed the folks there, Nikki and I were both appearing on a local television show on the news, and we met in the green room. And Nikki and I had probably met before in debates and things. I'm not too sure. But when I went into the green room that night, Nikki was sitting there, and normally I would have gone over and put my arms around her and hugged her and told her I was sorry about these people that she loved that she lost. But because of the position that I was in, I didn't do that, and that's a very great regret of my life. And this dialogue taught me how to respect the person without respecting the position. And so we, over the years, we've developed friendships among the women who were involved in this dialogue, and I think that's helped lower the rhetoric and actually helped to forward a civil conversation, at least in this area, on this issue.
And Nikki Nichols Gamble, let me follow up and ask you at that point, since you guys were the appearing on the media programs, the people being asked for quotes, the people that the reporters turned to after such incidents, do you feel, is that the way, in effect, that you feel that you helped to ratchet down the situation?
Yes, I think the Boston Globe, in fact, commented a year after our dialogue had started that they had noticed a reduction in demonization. A much more civil dialogue was taking place in Boston. And I think we deserve credit for a substantial amount of that. I know that I really did change not only how I spoke about people, but I changed how I thought about them. Fran alluded to the incident in which we met on the day of the killings, and I wouldn't have let her hug me, you know, if she had wanted to, because I had no connection with her other than sort of a deep animosity. That has changed remarkably. It did change, and it has remained changed for 11 years now.
At the same time, Francis Hogan, you say you respect the person, but not the opinion. How long can you go in a dialogue before approaching the irreducible, that vast gulf of disagreement?
Well, it took us quite a while because first we had to get rid of all the hot-button issues. I mean, we were doing this for about 6 years, and it finally came across to us that there was an enormous chasm between us, not just relating to abortion, but almost complete differences in views of the world, the role of the human person in society, the role of law, our responsibility is for the other person. So we did come to understand that we had completely different worldviews and there was a large chasm. But we wanted others to hear what we were saying. From the pro-life perspective, I can tell you that I felt that this allowed us to be heard in places we would never have been heard before. And so lowering the rhetoric helped politically, so to speak, even though it was also good to have civil discourse in general.
And would you agree from the pro-choice side?
Well, I think one of the most important differences Fran has mentioned today, and that's this question about whether you can respect a point of view that is dramatically different from yours on something as profound and fundamental as the question of abortion. And I think actually the fact that I am able to both respect her point of view and respect her as a person, yet she is not able to respect my point of view, is one of the very main differences that reflects a worldview difference. The worldview on the part of those of us who are pro-choice, I think, tends to be a view that says that it is possible, in fact, to respect a whole variety of points of view along a wide spectrum of issues, and you don't have to assume that everyone else is wrong, even though you have a truth that works for yourself. So that's I think, the difference that we discovered, and I think it is an enormous one.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in the conversation. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Nikki Nichols-Gamble and Frances Hogan, and let's see if we can get Chris on the line. Chris calling us from Sherborne in Massachusetts.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I want to take a position as somebody who really hates abortion but believes in a woman's right to choose. And I'm curious to know whether or not the group discussed contraception as something that has the potential to really diffuse the whole issue. In a world that has distinctly problems with overpopulation and venereal disease, I'm wondering whether the groups themselves and their ability to talk to the Catholic Church, for instance, could be something that would promote a greater openness toward contraception as something to diffuse the issue.
Frances Hogan, let me begin with you.
Well, I can say we certainly discussed it, at least in a brief way, I would say. However, from my perspective, contraception is perfectly legal in Massachusetts and is not an issue in terms of the legal front. What the beliefs of any particular faith may be is fine. Those people who believe in that faith should practice it. However, in terms of the law, we're not asking that the law be changed with respect to contraception. So to me, it was not a big issue.
And Nikki Nichols-Gamble?
Well, I think, in fact, it actually is a big issue, and it's an especially big issue from the point of view of those of us who are in the pro-choice side of this discussion, because we firmly believe that the active use of contraception, having sexuality education available, encouraging people to be responsible if they're going to be sexually active, is one of the main ways to avoid the need for abortion. So that our position always on this issue was that if you are opposed to abortion, if you hate abortion like the caller just said he does, then it really is incumbent upon you to embrace the use of contraception.
Okay. Chris, thanks very much for the call. We'll take more of your calls after we get back from a short break. We're discussing NPR's special series, Crossing the Divide, today, abortion. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. Today we're talking about how to address the divisive issue of abortion with two women who've tried. Frances Hogan is president of Women Affirming Life, a pro-life group in Massachusetts. Nikki Nichols-Gamble chairs the Center for Reproductive Rights, a New York-based organization that is pro-choice. And of course, you're invited to join our conversation. As always, is this an issue for your family or friends, or do you just avoid the topic or find a way not to talk about it? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Marvin. Marvin's calling us from Rapid City in South Dakota.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Neil. First, I want to thank you for taking my call, and secondly, tell you that I think you're the best interviewer out there.
That's a controversial issue, but go ahead with your question.
My comment is basically predicated or comes from my experience as a leader in South Dakota opposed to the abortion ban that went to the ballot this last November. I'm an OBGYN. I've spent a lot of time talking to a lot of my patients and my colleagues and my family about this contentious issue. And I guess my main comment is that the terms pro-choice and pro-life have oftentimes very little meaning. And when you ask people whether they consider themselves pro-life or pro-choice, in South Dakota anyways, most will say pro-life. But when you try to parse out their opinions based on gestational age or maternal circumstance or any of a number of other issues related to abortion, the majority of people agree on a large number of things. And I think that people who fall on one side of the spectrum that believe that abortion should be illegal under all circumstances constitute a small minority. People on the other end of the spectrum who believe that a woman's right to make her own autonomous health care decisions and nothing else matters are also a small minority, and the vast majority of people live somewhere in the middle of that political spectrum.
Would you agree with that, Nikki Nichols-Gamble?
Well, I think it's true that that there's clearly a spectrum of points of view about abortion in this country and in any given part of the country. And I think one of the points that I was trying to make earlier about not being willing to use the words pro-life to describe the other side is exactly, I think, what this man is is suggesting. The words pro-life, in my mind, suggest that one is supportive of life-affirming principles. And I believe that to be true of those who are pro-choice, just as it may be true on the other side as well.
Hmm. Francis?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think from the perspective of the pro-life movement that the idea of being pro-life means being pro-life at all of its phases, including unborn human life. So that's where I would disagree with Nikki, because I think that the pro-choice movement does not respect unborn human life. Secondly, with respect to what most people would respond in poll questions, I think it's quite important to ask what the question was. Most people in the United States find it shocking that abortion is legal for all 9 months. Most people think it's only legal for the first 3 months, but that's not true. So I think it's important when one is looking at poll results or what the opinions are. Most people are opposed, I believe, to most abortions, except perhaps for rape and incest and life of the mother, which is less than 1% of all abortions in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Nichols-Gamble would disagree with that.
Well, of course. I mean, first of all, abortion in certain circumstances can be legal late into a pregnancy, but 95%, if not more, of all abortions happen before the 12th week of pregnancy. And those that are occurring after that are frequently occurring because there is a condition, a maternal health condition, or there's a fetal abnormality, or there's a circumstance in the woman's life that has made it a situation where she has postponed a decision. But abortion in this country is very much a phenomenon of the first trimester of pregnancy. And then the other thing I want to say is that I think it's absolutely untrue that those of us who are pro-choice don't respect unborn life. What we are looking at and thinking about is a whole variety of competing priorities that occur in the lives of women during their childbearing years. And because one has an abortion is not a reflection that you disrespect unborn life. It may be that you simply find that your priority has to be born life, for example, other children you have, other responsibilities you have in the world.
Let me flip Marvin's question around just a little bit and see if that can get back to some of what he's trying to get at in his question. And that is, tactically, Francis Hogan, tactically, wouldn't you be better off describing the other side, as you were talking about it earlier, as demonizing the other side, trying to make them look as extreme as possible so that your position then looks more reasonable?
Well, I'm committed to the truth because I believe the truth has a beauty all its own. And what I would like to see is a civil conversation about this issue, speaking, the facts. When we had our dialogue for 6 years, there were many times where we couldn't even agree on the facts. It's amazing how good people can disagree. But I do think that the important thing is to have the civil conversation. In no way do I want to demonize anyone. I want the truth to come out because from my perspective, I believe that the pro-life ethic is the truth, and that if it were fully exhibited to society in all of its beauty, that more people would become pro-life.
And you, the same question to you, Nikki Nichols-Gamble. Again, if the other side's a nutcase, then you're going to win.
Well, I think perhaps there's some truth to that. But but clearly, I think if your goal is to try to reduce violence and anger, you can't just broad brush the other side by calling them all nutcases. There are probably some nutcases in both camps, and I think it's categorically wrong to simply say that the other side are not thoughtful, that they are all violent, and that that they are people without conscience. That's not true, and I don't think it would do my side any good if we tried to present that as the truth.
Marvin, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And I
wanted to say that in the past 6 years, as you guys have been holding these meetings, and it's not unconnected to that, certainly not in Massachusetts, but it does seem to me that a lot of the venom in this argument is no longer there as strongly as it was 6 years ago. Would you agree, Frances Hogan?
Yes. You have to recall that our dialogue began in 1995 and sort of ended in 01, something like that, although we have met occasionally since then. I honestly believe that there has been a more civil conversation about this taking place at many different levels, nationally as well as locally, and I think that's very helpful.
Would you agree, and Nikki Gamble?
Yes, I would agree. You know, I think it's hard sitting in one particular community to know what's happening everywhere else in the country. But certainly, I think in Boston, the dialogue is at a much more elevated level, and that it leads to greater understanding.
Mm-hmm. Given the delicacy with which you guys approach this, now, there was meetings in secret. There were two facilitators there, very highly skilled women who helped you all to negotiate some of the ground rules so that you could have these conversations. I wonder, given all of that, of course, this group was a group of very powerful activists from both sides, too. But could you have any advice on to normal people who want to discuss this in their lives, with their family, with their friends, with coworkers? It does come up.
I think that the major advice that I would have for people in general is that they ought to seek out opportunities to talk about divisive issues. That we tend to, I think, only want to talk to people with whom we agree. And when you do that, you never have a chance to really expand your own point of view on an issue. So I think that it's something that is very important to talk about. And I think we were fortunate that we had so many supports while we were doing it. But I don't think you absolutely have to have all of the support that we had. And there's certainly lots of resources that can help people learn how to have discussions across difference. And I think it's an enormously important thing to learn to do, not just because of the abortion issue, but because of all kinds of other contentious issues in our society.
Frances Hogan, advice?
Well, what happened to me is by profession, I'm a practicing attorney in Boston. And the experience that I had after the article came out was many people said to me, Fran, I didn't know there were any sane people on the pro-life side. Honestly, it's the truth. And I was kind of shocked by that. But what that did is it allowed a conversation to occur between me and some of my clients and some other people. As Nikki said, it opened doors up to allow these conversations to occur, which people had totally avoided. And from a person who's been active in the pro-life movement for more than 35 years, for me, it gave me the chance to have people not think I was completely insane, which was really the tenor of the discussion to a great extent, I believe.
Let's see if we get another listener on the line. This is Melissa. Melissa with us from San Francisco.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Good. What I was wanting to bring up was there's an interesting thing in the clinical terminology with regards to both miscarriages and abortions. And I think one thing that might be stigmatizing a lot of it is that, you know, when a woman has a miscarriage, they call it a spontaneous abortion. And they don't call it a miscarriage in the clinical world. And I think if people redefined their terminology and made miscarriages miscarriages and called abortions medical miscarriages, I think that might bring down a lot of the stigma on both ends, for the women who've had miscarriages not being told they had a spontaneous abortion, and on the other end, for the women who have had abortions, they would be a medical miscarriage, mm-hmm. or medically induced miscarriage. And I think that might be something that can help smooth the lines over as well. That hasn't been, I've never heard brought up.
Frances Hogan, would that be helpful?
No. I don't think so, because I think that people know what an abortion is and they know what a miscarriage is. And most women know a miscarriage is a spontaneous abortion. I don't think there's any question that people know what an abortion is and what a miscarriage is. I really don't.
And would you agree with that, Nikki?
I agree with Fran Hogan. I don't think that the caller's suggestion would make a difference.
Okay.
All right, Melissa, thanks for the suggestion anyway. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
We're talking with Frances Hogan, president of Women Affirming Life, and with Nikki Nichols-Gamble, who chairs the Center for Reproductive Rights, about a series of meetings they and other women held in Massachusetts that ended, well, it didn't quite end 6 years ago, but culminated 6 years ago, as they discussed the issue of abortion very carefully and delicately and learned to respect each other's opinions, if not necessarily agree with them. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is, Ed calling from Boston.
Hi, Neil. Great show. And
thank you.
I'm glad to be on the show. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. And in Boston and in all of Massachusetts, we're debating in the public square the issue of same-sex marriage. And so I'm wondering if your guests today have any thoughts on best practices on how to go about having that debate.
Well, I mean,
I can see you looking at each other.
some of the ground rules that we developed in our conversation, i.e., to avoid hot buttons, to listen and try to repeat back to someone what they have said, so that you can be sure that you are understanding what they've said and the other person feels understood. Those are two important ways to try to actually establish the facts that you might be talking about or arguing about and see if you can come to some agreement about what those are. I think that's a topic that's very much like the abortion question. It generates very heated emotion and very profound conviction on both sides. And it requires the same sort of careful approach that the abortion discussion requires.
Frances Hogan?
Well, if I can jump in here, I happen to have been on Emily Rooney's show, who is a local talk show host on the local public television channel, with one of the women from the dialogue on the same-sex marriage issue, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern about it that I had is I kind of brought all my little tools from our public conversations seminars on this. But her point was that she did not feel that the leadership of the Catholic Church in Massachusetts, in terms of the bishop, should be speaking publicly on this issue. And that angered me, and I said that on the show, and I would say that now, because I felt that one of the things we learned was to let people speak. We're not afraid of people speaking. Let them speak, let them have what they want to say, and let's discuss it. But I don't think we should ever tell people that they have no right to speak. And so I would agree with Nikki in terms of the other tools that should be brought to that discussion, but I do think that no one should be marginalized and no one should be put out of a public debate on any issue.
Is it easier or harder that this is an issue that could be coming up for important votes?
Well, I think whenever we have a legislative debate going on in the state, that it generates its own heat and sometimes its own irrational perspective from both sides of any argument. But I remember when abortion was, debated in much the same way that the same-sex marriage issue is debating. I think it does. It raises the stakes considerably for the different sides. They're fighting very hard for what they believe on both sides. And it means that you're not only trying to explain your point of view, but you're trying to convince others to vote a point of view or vote in the way that you would have them do so.
See, and I think that the public conversations taught me that my advocacy can be done in a way which is more convincing by using the tools that we were taught. So I'm completely passionate about my position, even more so possibly, but that I think that doing it in this kind of respectful, civilized manner is helpful to the position that I hold.
Thank you.
It's helpful to any position, I think, to do it with
sharpen
civility.
Your wits, absolutely,
right.
and a little civility, too. Thank you both so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We heard Nikki Nichols-Gamble, the chair of the Center for Reproductive Rights, and Frances Hogan, president of Women Affirming Life. Both were kind enough to join us today from the studios of our member station in Boston, WBUR. When we come back from a short break, the Talk of the Nation opinion page and a libertarian argument in favor of surveillance cameras. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to get in on that conversation. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.